Just in time for summer, the folks at Epic Brewing have released a new canned cocktail, the Utah Margarita. A delicious blend of real lime and agave, the Utah Margarita is ready to drink by the river or in the park. And here's the kicker, no need to buy it at a liquor store. Pick up a six-pack of Epic Brewing's Utah Margarita at any local Harmon's or Trader Joe's, or visit Epic Brewing on State Street in downtown Salt Lake City. Here's what Salt Lake's talking about. At 11:54 p.m. on Friday night, House Speaker Mike Schultz declared sign die, which means Utah's 2024 legislative session is over. Since January, state senators and representatives have passed 591 bills and a $29 billion budget. It's a lot. So we are breaking down how it all impacts your life over two episodes with Fox 13's Ben Winslow. Today, part one, two new stadiums downtown, the Great Salt Lake, and calendars. It's Tuesday, March 5th. I'm Allie Vallarta, and this is CityCast Salt Lake. Ben Winslow, Fox 13 Capitol Hill reporter, you are hot off the 45-day legislative session and on a much-deserved vacation, but you have graciously agreed to meet with me, so let's waste absolutely no time.
No problem.
Okay, we're starting with sports, which apparently is, like, almost our new religion here in Utah.
We are sports crazy.
We're losing it. Near the end of the session, we saw two big bills creating sports and entertainment districts in Salt Lake City. They were introduced, they passed. We've talked about them on the show in early stages, but I want to know from you, what are the final iterations?
Okay, so these bills did change a lot. So the big thing is, it's how they're paid for. So what we are doing is we have created a couple of districts, and it's sort of how the by mechanism by which they do this, because political leaders have said they do not favor writing checks directly to billionaires. But there's ways around that, that you can help out and kind of, you know, get this going, because these are very expensive propositions. So what happened? Let's start with the Major League Baseball bill, which what this does is this helps kick some money toward a state-owned stadium on land right now where Rocky Mountain Power is on North Temple, right across from the Fair Park. There's an empty parking lot there. That's all going to be developed into the Power District, which is a new development by the Larry H. Miller Group. Billions and billions of dollars that are going to go into that. Well, part of that will house a Major League Baseball stadium. And the original version of the bill proposed this idea that they would raise the hotel tax by about a percentage and a half, you know, to do that statewide, raise the car rental tax to help pay for that. That did not go over well with lawmakers in Southern Utah, who argued, why should we in St. George be paying for a stadium in Salt Lake City? And that's a fair question. Absolutely, it's a fair question. So you had the complaints about that. You had a lot of complaints. And so to ease the minds of those lawmakers and actually ensure passage in the House, what they did is they changed that. So they're creating a district and basically dipping into the sales tax of whatever the Larry H. Miller Company develops within that area. So it'll have its own tax on it, and then that money feeds into the stadium project. And it should be important to know that none of this takes effect without the franchise moving in. So this is this weird world of taxes where things exist, but they don't exist until they exist. But it's a way of paying for it without paying for it, in a way. I know this sort of Ouroboros logic is just really weird, but this is tax world. There was one thing in the bill that rural Utahns really, 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 really wanted. They wanted a percentage of that hotel tax that would go toward paying for emergency medical service and search and rescue, which is badly needed in rural areas. They're seeing a huge influx of tourists from the Mighty Five. People go do stupid things for the Grams and get themselves in trouble, and then they got to go rescue them, and they really wanted that. Well, in reworking the tax deal for the Major League Baseball bill, gone is that provision, so try again next year. But that's that bill.
Quick follow-up question on that. So, like, because often I feel like we pay for these projects with taxes, and I never know what the end date is. So, like, are we dipping into sales tax in that district to pay for stadium costs eternally? Like, is that just a stadium fund? Or will there be a date where, in fact, we've, like, paid off the $1 billion that we've agreed to, I mean, quote-unquote, publicly finance in some regard of the stadium, and then after that, we move on?
I believe there's a shelf life on this to pay for the stadium, and then I think it's 30 years, I think. Okay. And then the other provision of this is if a team within that period packs up and leaves and decides, we're done with you, Salt Lake City, we're going to the next shiny green space over
here. We're going to Omaha.
Yeah, exactly. Then they owe the state $900 million. So there is some terms in there, sort of a catch-all to try to ensure that. And what is also really unique, though, about this bill is this is a state-owned stadium. And that is very, very unusual. But the state will be able to use that as an asset. And let's say if the team isn't playing, you know, you could hold concerts there or whatever. So that was the selling point to get it there. And the governor said he's going to sign that one.
Okay. So one bill like this is huge and could radically change the way our city looks and feels for generations. But we got two. So let's talk about the bill that targets downtown and the NHL and the NBA stadium.
Sure. So the hockey bill was huge. And this involved Utah Jazz owners Ryan and Ashley Smith and the Smith Entertainment Group. And this is a significant bill also because the way that it is structured as far as paying for it as well. This is interesting. So they're going to create what is essentially a downtown reinvestment district. And this is 9-block radius, basically, around the Delta Center.
9 blocks? That's a lot. That's
huge. That's the zone for this reinvestment district. It was originally a sports and entertainment district. It now became a reinvestment zone. And it basically is a mechanism that pumps in money or allows for, you know, a lot of infrastructure and things like that to be thrown in a lot easier with legislative oversight. The difference between an entertainment district and a reinvestment zone, well, that's the legislature. The way that this works is a little different than the baseball bill. So this one, at least when it comes to the taxing structure and who pays for it and everything, is you, the Salt Lake City resident. This one dumps it on Salt Lake City leaders and says, you get the option of voting to raise the sales tax by a 0.5 percentage point to help pay for some of the infrastructure and some of the capital improvements and things like that that you need. The goal here is either to create a new National Hockey League arena, should we land a team, or remodel the Delta Center to be both a joint NHL and NBA arena. This also ensures, of course, that the Jazz are happy and that they're not planning to go to Point of the Mountain or any place else like that, as had been rumored. And then it also pumps a lot more money in, think, for the Olympics and revitalizing downtown and, you know, doing a lot for the communities. Both of these bills have the support of Salt Lake City leaders. They view it as investment in the area, particularly for the West Side. On the baseball bill, just one other note on that, I don't think I've ever seen a bill like that that had so much support from Democrats, because their districts are all that area, and they said their residents wanted it. People viewed it as an economic stimulus, as an investment in a very long neglected part of the city. Hmm. But back to the point of who pays for this, Salt Lake City leaders, the mayor, the city council, will have to decide if they want to raise the sales taxes in the city to help cover that. You also have to remember, a lot of people do come into the city Monday through Friday and on weekends for events and things like that, and they do spend money. So, you know, that will also go into this. But the other thing that kind of won support for the NHL bill, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which is not a tiny property owner in downtown Salt Lake City.
No.
They also threw their support behind it. So yeah, that kind of really, all of this led to it. And the hockey bill got through as well with widespread support, even though the taxing and the way that it's paid for is a little bit different.
I mean, if you're the Salt Lake City Council, you're kind of between a rock and a hard place right now, because if you don't vote for the tax increase, you're going to be the people that lost the NHL and maybe the Jazz from downtown, right?
It really is interesting. And then part of it is they all have to go back to the legislature and explain their actions.
Right. So, but at the same time, all people do is complain about construction in this city. And it's like, wait till we reimagine 10 blocks downtown.
And I don't even know if it'll be the whole 10 blocks, but I know that what it's going to do is just going to—it's for that area. And the area, if people are really curious about, like, well, where are they going to put it? There is a chance that basically the Delta Center gets remodeled. But they're also eyeballing this area right behind the Salt Palace, known as Japantown. And so that area could be significantly impacted. In fact, there was a lot of references in floor speeches to ensuring that Salt Lake City's Japanese-American community is involved in this, because it's likely that that whole area is going to be significantly impacted by whatever design plans come out.
Well, and that would be a lesson learned, because they weren't when the Salt Palace was built and basically obliterated Japantown in its previous form. Epic Brewing is one of the OGs in building Utah's craft beer scene. But I am most excited about their recent adventures in canned cocktails. First, they released the Utah Mule. And as a big fan of ginger, I have been sipping those for almost a year now. But now, this April, we have the Utah Margarita, a delicious, locally fermented blend of real lime and agave, and they create alcohol by fermenting cane sugar instead of using tequila, which means you can buy Utah margaritas at the grocery store. Pick up a six-pack of Epic Brewing's Utah Margarita or Utah Mule at any local Harmon's or Trader Joe's, or you can visit Epic Brewery on State Street in downtown Salt Lake City. They're open 7 days a week. And this fall, look out for the Utah Cosmo.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Okay, let's talk about water, because former House Speaker Brad Wilson was, you know, kind of a self-proclaimed champion for the Great Salt Lake, which of course is probably the greatest existential environmental threat facing this valley. If the lake dries up, we suffer toxic dust storms. It's possible we're kind of already experiencing those dust storms a bit. But Brad Wilson is gone now. He is busy running for U.S. Senate. How did the lake fare this session?
The lake fared very well. You would have thought, and I certainly went into this session thinking that, you know, new Speaker Mike Schultz has his own priorities. The Great Salt Lake will not be the same priority because, you know, it's just a different person and they have their own legislative agenda. Mm. Boy, was I wrong. The new Speaker is very much a champion of the Great Salt Lake, so much to the point so that he picked a fight with mineral extraction companies, and a very public fight. Mm. A bill was run that reworks how water laws work on the Great Salt Lake. And a little bit of history here for everybody. The Great Salt Lake is a terminal basin, which means that all the water that flows in, it doesn't flow out. That's it. That's the end of the line. So when it came to water laws and how things worked on the lake with mineral extraction, Republican leaders argued that essentially all you had to do was you could take whatever you wanted. And their argument was is that some of these companies were just taking, taking, taking. So they rewrote the laws. And they basically said that you, in lean years, you get cuts just like everybody else does. So you can't just take, 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 take. They also raised the taxes on the minerals that companies extract, the money that's due to the state. And a lot of that money is going to be earmarked toward environmental initiatives and lake issues and things like that. So it was kind of an interesting bill. And so they pushed this bill through and it had a lot of support. And it is significant in what it will do in terms of ensuring the water remains in the Great Salt Lake and helping. And what we've seen was truly unusual is there were environmental groups like Friends of Great Salt Lake and the Great Basin Water Network that were even surprised that they were on the side of this bill being run by the speaker. There were other bills dealing with the Great Salt Lake and water conservation that solved some problems. And they're not sexy bills.
They never are.
No, water policy is definitely not sexy, folks. But it is, they ensure that water that is conserved, that a water rights holder can donate it or send it downstream without fear of losing their water rights. So Utah has a use it or lose it water philosophy. It's existed since the state was founded. And so that's a big bill that just kind of helps that. We have bills that now restrict HOAs and say you can't demand lush green grass anymore. There were, of course, a number of Great Salt Lake bills that just simply did not get hearings and just did not advance. A lot of those were proposed for studies, things like that. But by and large, the lake did pretty well this session.
Something that Democrats have tried to do in years past, in particular, is run a bill that sets a minimum level, water level for the lake. Like, can we just agree that we want the lake to never drop before this level? And that bill always struggles to get through.
Except this year.
Is it about who's running it?
No. Well, maybe. Yes and no. Here's what happened. That actually wound up in the mineral extraction bill.
Interesting.
Yeah, that is there. But it's not a level. It is a range. And it sets what's called a healthy range, and it's based on salinity of the lake. And so it accomplishes the same thing, not necessarily tied to a level of water. It basically how much salt there is. If you get too much, you start to kill off a lot of things. And if you get too little, obviously you're diluting the lake. And so it's all about ecosystem balance. There's triggers in there from what I understand.
I just want to quickly ask you, because I feel like the lake is one of those issues that at the end of the legislative session, no matter how much the speaker and the Senate president say they've done for the lake, there's still this like penetrating anxiety among people who are like, okay, but so does that mean we don't do anything between now and next January, general legislative session 2025? I know last year we got Great Salt Lake Commissioner Brian Seed appointed. He's kind of hard at work. We've got a strategic plan for the lake now that we've talked about on this show. But there was a bill that set up kind of like a governing committee for the lake. That was Senate President Stuart Adams' bill. I know a lot of activists had concerns with transparency when it came to that bill. Who's in charge of decision-making now about the lake between now and the next legislative session? Or who's informing them?
So it's still the commissioner, and that bill is actually not really related to the lake. It kind of sort of is. The Generational Water Investment Bill is more about finding new sources of water. And it's a weird bill. If you want to take a minute, we can talk about this because it does a lot.
What are some of the highlights?
Yeah, so what it does is it creates this commissioner and water commission that's goal is to explore new sources of water because Utah's still going to grow no matter what. And we only have a finite source of water. So this bill envisions new ideas, out-of-the-box thinking, and it's got about a $4 million fiscal note, so they get $4 million to spend to do this. And this could involve negotiating with other states for maybe their water shares. One of the ideas that was floated was the idea of maybe we kick some money to California, give them money, and say, you build a desalination plant with this. You have the Pacific Ocean right there. That solves your water problems. And then we take your shares of Colorado River water. This also does look toward other things like pipeline projects and ideas to potentially get water into the state. It's mostly geared toward water importation and less with the Great Salt Lake, although the Senate president who sponsored the bill argued that, look, all of this could ultimately benefit the Great Salt Lake. These are obviously out-of-the-box ideas, very long-term ideas, TBD on what they actually do. But it is a significant bill from that viewpoint. Obviously, critics of the bill have been like, we could also try conservation. but they view this as part of just, when you look at the overall picture, when you step back, this is one piece of it that could potentially just help with figuring out some new ways to ensure that we have an adequate water supply going forward for generations.
But it also really requires that we have good relationships with people like the governor of California.
And the Senate president's argument is, hey, there's no harm in trying and there's no harm in thinking, looking at these things from a different lens or a viewpoint and maybe seeing if we can get some new ideas that maybe help us all out.
Before I let you go today, I want to talk to you about transparency, because that's why we're here. Like, for you and I, that's our raison d'exist. Without being able to shine a light on these conversations, these negotiations, what's happening at the legislature, we kind of remain in the dark as regular non-lawmaking people. And some elected officials were a little hostile towards the media this session. The Trib kind of went to bat a little bit for some of their reporters on the Hill. House Speaker Mike Schultz said it's not reporters' job to hold elected officials accountable, which is certainly a take. Representative Kira Berkland said, "We do not have an honest journalism system, with a few exceptions." How has this attitude towards journalists changed this year? What's inciting this panic?
There's been certainly a lot of viewpoints that they feel picked on, or that their policies are not fully explained, or that there's flashy clickbait kind of headlines that have been put out there that miss the context of the other parts of the bills that they're running, that they feel sort of tell a more complete story to voters and to constituents about what is happening in their bills. And certainly a lot of them do get headlines. And what they see is that people are not necessarily reading beyond the headlines or watching, you know, more than the highlight or things like that. So, you know, there definitely was a lot of that. And we saw that also play out in some of the legislation. Some of the legislation was also fundamental disagreements over, you know, what should be a public record and what should not, and, you know, what people should have to provide and what they should not. You know, and you think about in the context of the grandma bill that passed. Worth pointing out, that was a bill that was done for the news media.
Okay, wait, you have to define grandma, because otherwise people are going to think that it's an anti-grandma, anti-grandmother legislation who are not in the media with us.
No, we love our grandma. It is the Government Records Access Management Act, and it is Utah's public records laws. In other states, it may be called a sunshine law, but this is the laws that you use when you want to fill out and get a copy of a police report. That's the form that you fill out, and is the laws by which you get those reports. And, you know, not just us in the news media use it, the public uses it a lot too. The law that did pass, the bill that was run by Senator Kurt Bramble, started out, and it was on behalf, as he said, of the Utah Media Coalition, which is sort of the lobbying arm that represents news media interests on Capitol Hill. And what it allowed to do is in cases where you prevail, because fighting for public records is a very expensive thing. Sometimes you have to go to court. Lawyers are expensive, as we all know. It just adds up. So this bill actually gave you a little more money should you prevail. And that was great. The part that the media and others did not like was the part that declared that public officials' calendars were a protected record. Utah law already said that to a certain extent. But there was a court case against Attorney General Sean Reyes for his public calendar, and he has not provided one since he took office. KSL sought those to see what he was doing, and he refused, and it went to court. And the argument was the State Records Committee had said that they believed that his calendar should be public. Lawmakers had a fundamental disagreement with that decision, because their argument was the law had already clarified or had said that these were protected records. However, this bill, the provision in there, would have further clarified it. There were negotiations, from what I understand, to try to, you know, amend that, maybe find some ways so that, you know, everybody gets a little of what they want. What happened was, is when that bill hit the House, the judge had ruled in the KSL versus Attorney General Reyes case and said that the calendar should be public. And the backlash from Capitol Hill was swift. It passed. Many lawmakers I spoke with had expressed concerns about seeing their own lives just flayed open for the press to see, doctor's appointments, kids' soccer games. Some felt it was a security threat, that everybody would know where they were at all times. Now, some of this may be overblown. Some of it may be a legitimate grievance. But they passed that bill very quickly, and the governor signed it 24 hours later, and it went into effect upon signature of the governor. So that is the laws that we live under. What I have observed, though, is a little bit of interesting pushback on that. Brian King, the Democratic candidate for governor, released his legislative schedule in protest of that ruling. And he posted it. Here you go. You can see who I'm meeting with. Governor Spencer Cox, who did sign that bill, continues to release a public calendar. Obviously, the public calendars that are released are not the true calendars, so you don't see everything. But at least it does show that there is still, on some executive branch members' calendars, or at least on their end, a desire to at least continue to show some sort of transparency. But it's optional on their part.
It's so unusual because for those of us with office jobs, it's kind of expected that things that are on your calendar associated with your work email are public. Like, my coworkers can see what I'm doing in the day that are calendar events that are created by my work email. I use a separate email to book bikini waxes, you know, but it's like, I don't know. It feels like one of those things that we all kind of share our calendar in that way. Like, what's the hubbub? What are you afraid of?
There is an argument for that, but this was, again, at its heart, a fundamental disagreement in philosophy of, you know, how that law is interpreted and how it ought to be interpreted. But yeah, I don't know what this is going to look like going forward when we start to, you know, wanting to know, because there are legitimate things. It's interesting to know who people are meeting with, what policy positions they're considering, who is courting them for their support behind something. And this is going to be an interesting one to watch play out in the future to figure out, you know, how much do we get insight into where our public officials are going and who they're talking to.
Yeah. Feels very related to Ryan Smith closing his suite at the Delta Center off to the media the day after Andy Larson tweets that he saw Senate President Stuart Adams in there. Like, you know whose calendar I want to see? Gail Miller's. Actually, not Kira Berkland's. All right, Ben Winslow, Fox 13 reporter, thank you so much. I will see you tomorrow for part two.
Looking forward to it.
That is all for us today here on CityCast Salt Lake. Thank you for listening. We will be back tomorrow morning with Ben Winslow and part two of Everything the Legislature Did to Your Life: Housing, Bars and Restaurants, and Air Quality.